boy, what a talent he was. You know, I don't even have her name, though. But a good duo there. Roby Duke and his song Our Love here, 24 minutes past the hour. And we have surmounted the technical difficulties here. Doug Greenwald is with us. Doug, the Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director of Preserving Bible Times. And he comes to us from Columbia, Maryland, just outside of Washington, where there's lots of hubbub going on, as usual. We kind of walk a more peaceful road here, though. And today, Doug, what say we talk about food? I mean, Thanksgiving coming up tomorrow. And, you know, food was a big thing in the Jewish culture. Eating together was a high privilege.
And, well, particularly if I invited you to my house and had you recline around the triclinium table, three-sided clinium Latin to recline, the typical way that extensive banquets, dinners were held.
That would sure feel odd, wouldn't it, here in our culture? Lying down, you'd be lying on your left shoulder, packed in on three people to a couch on three sides of a table. Wasn't that more of a Roman custom?
Oh, it very much was. And if you were a fairly wealthy Roman, you reclined on a chaise lounge, which was then sideways with the table. So, you know, that was fairly convenient. But if you were poor people, you were leaning on your elbow most of the night.
And
your left elbow.
That meant an intimate position with your neighbor. I mean, that wouldn't fly here. You'd be violating people's personal space, right and left.
It would, and if you wanted to talk to the person in back of you, of course, you have your back to that person. You have to lean back, put your right shoulder basically on that person's breastplate, and, you know, if you think about the intimacy of that, the two faces are probably about 6 inches apart.
Yeah, that would be a little odd for us, a little uncomfortable. I'm not sure I would fit into that kind of a thing. But the four side of that table, now normally there would be, you know, up to nine people there. There's three people on each of three sides. The fourth side was for serving and for entertainers to appear, right?
Philosophers.
The philosophers, okay.
Would be typical. That would be considered the entertainment.
You mean stand-up comedians?
Well, philosophers in our culture, I think, are highly respected. They were almost the lowest of the low in Roman society. In fact, the lowest person in the whole social rung there was an entertainer.
Wouldn't have guessed that.
There's some virtue to that that we might rediscover for Hollywood today.
I think maybe so. Yeah.
But yeah, and typically it might be a solid table on three sides, or it might be a U-shaped table.
Well, in the case of the Last Supper, you would have figured it was full with 13 present at the dinner.
Yeah, there could have been roughly four on each side and one solid end, or it could have been an open U. And the serving people, of course, it's easier to work as a serving person if you can go in the interior of the U there, you know, and deal with the three sides. But those are typical, the two configurations that we see from the past that help us understand the dynamics of the Last Supper, the triclinium table, and some of the symbolism that goes with that.
The foot washing, too, because your feet would be accessible in that position, not sitting at a table.
Yeah, they're sticking out the backside of all this, if you will. And so it's fairly easy for a person to work the feet on the outside, I won't say radius, it's not quite the circle, outside circumference, if you will, of all these bodies reclining toward the table.
So it's odd for me to realize that Leonardo had it all wrong in his painting.
He sure did. And what's really funny, or humorous maybe is the word, is if you go to the Vatican Museum and you look at a lot of the great master's paintings of biblical scenes, because, you know, and during the Dark Ages, paintings were the only way that Bible stories were communicated to the masses. The masses were illiterate. There were no Bibles. You know, Gutenberg hadn't done his thing yet. The priests weren't particularly well trained in what we would call a homily today. And so the Bible education of the masses was done by paintings on the walls of the cathedrals. Well, the imagination of some of these painters, you know, almost like had Disneyland profiled in the background with, you know, Cinderella's castle and all that sort of stuff.
Well, I wonder if that wasn't a way to attract more visitors, to fill the pews, so to speak, just by being a talked about your art and rising head and shoulders above the church down the street.
Well, the church down the street was of the same faith. During the Dark Ages, yeah, it was true. Just the historic Roman church. And whether that attracted people to come, I don't know. I suspect the alms box probably kept them away. But, yeah, that's just part of the dynamics of the Dark Ages and the early church. And the paintings, like Da Vinci, just didn't do it justice, certainly from a contextual point of view.
And I think of animal sacrifice. That's symbolic of food for God, isn't it? Is it not? I mean, and then, of course, the priests and Levites would eat a portion of some of the sacrifices. So food was an important part of worship.
Well, yeah, the 10% tithe, so to speak, often was of a food nature, and that's how the thousands of ordinary priests sustained themselves, were fed.
What about banquets, though? I mean, certainly if you have hundreds of, I'm thinking of maybe the wedding at Cana. That would have been a different format, wouldn't it?
That would have most likely taken place. Let's say we had 100 people. If you look at even some of the multi-room homes, what's called our insula homes in the first century, you're not going to get 100 people in one of those rooms. So you're going to be in multiple rooms, but by and large, you're going to be overflowing and spread out in the open courtyard. That's where most of this particular wedding celebration is going to take place, if you have any size at all. And, you know, because we're dealing with villages here, and most of the clan lives in the village with you. They're not strangers. You've got the whole social reciprocity, mandatory hospitality thing. You wouldn't dare slight anybody in the village not to be invited to your daughter's or son's daughter's wedding feast. And so, typically these are going to be substantially sized crowds.
Just a note from a listener here, SAS comments that in a pre-archaeology age, the artists applied contemporary motifs, talking about paintings and wall paintings and murals, applied contemporary motifs, clothing and buildings to the Bible stories. It's kind of an excuse for them. They had no archaeological knowledge, apparently, no written record of what it looked like in the first century.
Well, no one had ever traveled to Israel. No one, I don't think, had any idea of what it was like. And so another part of those paintings that puts a smile on my face is how lush they were. How many trees and vines and green fields. And if you've walked in southern Israel at all, and in the summertime everything is totally brown. Things are not green for very long. And so, yeah, they were left with their imagination. So if you were an Italian painter, you pulled in the Italian countryside.
The only
motif
reference
you knew.
Yeah. Well, Cana is what was in. Is there still a Cana? There's a green area.
There's a gospel area, gospel times Cana, in the Beth Netofa Valley. It has yet to be excavated. The last time I was there, I heard they were getting ready to do an excavation in Cana. Don't know whether that's taken place, but across the valley, the Beth Netofa Valley, is Cana of today, which, you know, most people think is Cana of the gospel times. You can buy a lot of wine there with a Cana wine label.
I bet you can.
Obviously, the association. But one of the things about Cana is it sits on the slopes of the Beth Netofa Valley. It's an east-west valley. It runs from the Mediterranean to about midpoint on the western shore of the Sea of Galilee. And it's just a beautiful, beautiful valley, one of the loveliest ones in Israel.
And it's between Nazareth and Capernaum.
It is, and what's interesting about that is if you get out a map and say, how am I going to go from Capernaum to Nazareth and vice versa, there are two choices. you can take the northern route. It's kind of hard to do this one on the radio, but basically you're going to go north out of Nazareth to a large city called Sepphoris, and you're going to keep going north until you get to around the Bethlehem Valley, and then you're going to swing east, and you're going to start heading towards the Sea of Galilee, and you know, you open up on the Plain of Magdala there. You hit the shore, and then you go north on the western shore of the Sea of Galilee to get to Capernaum. And when you measure that one out, that's 30 miles. If you took the southern route, it's going to be about 32 miles. You can't travel in a linear line from point A to point B because of all the topography issues, all the mountains, all the ridge lines here in this part of the of Israel. And so you'd say, well, okay, that's kind of interesting, but it gets more interesting when you realize that you walk in this culture. That's your only form of transportation unless you're really rich, and 90% of the people are very poor. And so you walk 16 to 18 miles a day on a good day, mostly flat land, or at least level land, not a lot of up and down. Well, that means you can't get from Nazareth to Capernaum in one day and vice versa. You got to lay over. And guess where the logical layover point is? Cana. So this leads to the reasonable speculation that Jesus, in making journeys back and forth between Nazareth and Capernaum, would have had to lay over, and probably laid over in Capernaum because they either have friends or relatives there. You know, if you just think about the passage for a moment, he's invited to the wedding feast with his brand new disciples. So he must be well known and highly regarded by that family. Generally, it's considered to be an honor to have a traveling itinerant capital R rabbi at your place. But it also suggests there's a prior relationship there. And that may well be because that's where Jesus laid over, because he would have had to have done that to break up the 30-mile trip into a 16-mile portion and maybe a 14-mile portion.
Well, he had friends and relatives around the Sea of Galilee, I mean, for his whole life growing up in Nazareth. I mean, he was familiar, he had cousins up there. There are lots of reasons for him to go back and forth even before his active ministry, don't you think?
Well, you know, that's all in the realm of speculation. We really know just about nothing about Jesus between age 12 and age 30. So there's lots of speculation you can make about that. But I would offset that a little bit by saying most people don't do a lot of traveling. I remember Jim Martin telling me when he went to a wedding feast in north of the Galilee, the Northern Galilee district, even in the 20th century, there were 3,000 people in this town, and 2,600 of them had the same last name, even today. So, you know, like the Zacharias of the world who lived in Judah, Ein Karim, a tradition tells us, a little village there, other than his journeys to the temple for his service, and to be part of his 26-week rotation and to be part of the major feasts and festivals, which was the other time all priests were on duty, you don't travel like we travel. Elizabeth and Zechariah didn't say to themselves, oh, let's take a trip to Galilee, you know, which is 95 miles away. You don't do that. Most people, other than going to the temple for the major festivals, probably never journeyed more than a couple miles from where they were born. So it's an interesting question. How often would Jesus, particularly as he got into his 20s, travel from Galilee, or in the Galilee, from Capernaum to Nazareth and vice versa? We can only speculate.
Now, Sepphoris is pretty close to Nazareth, though, because we've talked before about Joseph as a carpenter or a craftsman, maybe even worked in stone, probably had work in that area, primarily in Sepphoris, which was a bustling place with lots of building projects going on, and probably was accompanied by Jesus. How far is that from Nazareth to Sepphoris?
That's a four-mile walk, which in this culture is not a big deal at all.
Yeah, it wouldn't be.
The underlying Greek word would suggest he was a tradesman. If you've seen any of the remains of Sepphoris, also called Zippori, today, you realize the whole thing is made out of limestone. You don't really make a living as a carpenter up in this limestone-y part of the country. You may have to have a little finished carpentry skills, but you can't make full-time living that way. Sepphoris, by the way, was probably, estimates are, a size for 15,000 to 20,000 people. It took a long time to build that city. And the reasonable speculation is that Jesus and Joseph were stonemasons, primarily, and did all of their stonework outside the city limits of Sepphoris. I mean, it's a Greco-Roman city. They're forbidden to set foot in it.
That's right.
And probably employed Joseph and secondarily Jesus for 8 to 10 years once he came of age. But we're just speculating, but it's a reasonable speculation that knowing the proximities of the two cities and knowing the underlying tradesman basics of that culture. And so, you know, might ask yourself, where did we ever get this notion that Jesus was a carpenter? Did that ever occur to you?
Oh, yes, many times.
That's not an easy one to pin down cleanly either, but the best understanding I've run across is that back in the 800s, the historic Roman church decided we're going to see him as a carpenter, and that's where that tradition starts. And it's been around for so long that that tradition probably now has the total ring of truth. And when you suggest that probably Jesus was most likely a stonemason with maybe a little bit of carpentering skills, people look at you as if you've just spoken heresy.
I understand.
Because tradition, let me just finish off that thought.
Yeah.
Because oftentimes, tradition has a stronger grip on us than the truth.
Yes, it does. And that's a battle you encounter frequently in teaching context. Getting back to the wedding at Cana, I'm wondering, because Jesus was in the at the beginning of his ministry, probably within the first week of his having had his disciples with him. Do you suppose he attended as a rabbi or simply as a family friend? I mean, was his reputation established in Cana by that time, do you suppose?
Well, let's just deal with an obvious conclusion here. Because he has disciples, he's a rabbi. Most people would conclude that we're dealing with a week's worth of time here between the calling of these first disciples and showing up at this wedding. How much of a reputation would have spread by then, I don't know. I would, if I had to put my best surmission on the table here, he's here 90% as a friend and 10% as a rabbi at this moment in time. The friendship is certainly has a longer duration than does his period of time, which we think is, you know, around a week here, of being a rabbi.
So I have this image of him is with an entourage then. He's got six or seven. I don't know if he has the full complement of disciples that he had, because he had yet to pick up Levi and some others. But was that enough to set him apart?
The fact that he had any followers at all or any disciples sets him apart as a rabbi immediately. Rabbis are esteemed in this culture. If there's a preceding friendship, that's like just frosting on the cake. Not only is our friend here, but he's now a rabbi. That's just very distinctive in this culture. That's something for the clan to take a good deal of pride in. So, you know, maybe I'd go down to the 80-20 rule. He's there 80% as a friend and 20% as a rabbi. But he's there with disciples. And for every indication here, he has a prior relationship. And that really becomes important, because we have to try to understand subsequently here the interaction that Jesus has with his mother. And there's been lots of fascinating, and I think a little bit off the mark, speculation onto the tone of the conversation briefly that Jesus has with his mother. And I think it's best understood from the perspective of social reciprocity. And that's why I think it's important to try to wonder about, is there a pre-existing relationship here? Because if there is, now mandatory hospitality and social reciprocity go hand in hand. They're the unspoken participants in this wedding at Cana. They always are when we're in a village setting. And having made that observation, let me just say this. I've never read a synopsis of all the dynamics that implicitly take place in a village setting in the Near East in the first century. They're always there. They're always participants in the passage. They're so predominant. They're so prevalent. They're so well understood that none of the gospel writers ever even felt the need to explain them to us. So this wedding feast takes place in a village of Cana.
Well, we have to remember that they were writing for their contemporary audience, and they were worried about what we would think 2,000 years later.
The biblical writers, in this case John, always assumed that his readers lived when, where, and how he did. And so he had no need to explain what everyone knew to be true. In fact, it was so known to be true, there's no need to explain it. And that's the big, those are the big missing chunks of context we have to put back in place in the case of a village scene here. Obviously, mandatory hospitality is at work. Obviously, social reciprocity is at work. Here's another big one. Obviously, issues of honor and shame are at work. Mm. They're always at work in a village passage. They're an implicit participant of every one of these parables set in a village or encounters that are set in a village setting. And it's just amazing to me. No one's ever put out a little pamphlet saying, here are all the cultural dynamics at work in a village. There's also some physical dynamics. You know, these houses are all close together. 90% of them are just one room in size. That means there's no privacy in villages. That means there are no secrets in villages. If something happens in a family that's bad, like in John 15, when the younger son says to his father, Luke 15, the younger son says to his father, I want my money. I want my inheritance, and I want it now. Within 60 minutes, the whole village knows that that's happened. That family has just been shamed, that father has just been shamed. There are no secrets. And so these are the kind of dynamics, I think, that we just have to bring back to these village settings, weave them back into the fabric of the narrative. That's why so much of what's happening in these village scenes is between the lines. As my teaching colleague Randy Smith says, in the white spaces between the lines is where you're going to find much of the story. Mm-hmm. That's because it's a contextual story. And issues of mandatory social reciprocity and mandatory hospitality here really figure into unlocking the full fragrance, the full flavor, the full texture, if you will, of this particular wedding scene.
What about that encounter between Mary and Jesus? And I've heard, I guess there's some controversies around that. Was Jesus saying, I guess, what was the nature of the interchange? Was it a smile and a wink, or was it a serious discussion? Was she taking him to task, or vice versa? What were the dynamics there?
Well, let's actually read it from the text. Mm-hmm. When the wine, verse 3 of chapter 2 of John, when the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, they have no wine. And Jesus said to her, woman, what does that have to do with us? My hour has not yet come.
Does that leave me alone, or was he smiling as he said that?
Let me finish it up. And his mother said to the servants, whatever he says, do it. Now, picking up what you just suggested here, how do we recognize when Jesus is saying something seriously or when he's saying it facetiously? How do we recognize in the biblical passage when Jesus might be saying something tongue-in-cheek with a smile on his face? Answer, only by understanding the context. Without it, we'll totally miss it. So if social reciprocity is in vogue here, and it sure is, here's some of the backdrop now. Jesus, or Yeshua, this is between the lines. You've stayed here many a time on your journey from Capernaum back to Nazareth, Nazareth to Capernaum. These people have been good to you. They've put you up. You must be good to them if they ever need help. Okay? That's social reciprocity. You got to do it. And Jesus knows that.
Well, that suggests to me that Mary would have looked in his eyes and known that he was going to handle it.
She knows he has to respond. So the first thing she does is inform him of the need. And then he sort of winks at her and says, you know, what does that have to do with me? And why are you telling me this? And his mother, knowing exactly what's going on here, says, whatever he says you to do, do it. Because I know he's going to tell you to do something, so do it. So all this other stuff about, is Jesus mocking his mother here? Is this a form of derision? Is this a put down? All the speculations I've read in the commentaries through the years, I don't think come close, because no one is looking at this exchange, brief exchange though it is, through the lenses of cultural context and village dynamics.
You know, there's something else you've taught us, and we've covered it from time to time, and that's the parable now, the midnight visitor, when Jesus was teaching his disciples how to pray. By the way, this is something else that involves food and bread in this case. That turns out to be pretty much a joke, doesn't it? The comment that he was in bed with his children and couldn't get up.
Well, when Jesus says to his disciples, and I'm going to add a little bit of embellishment here. Can you imagine this ever happening? A visitor shows up at midnight in the village, and the friend goes to another friend and said, give me some bread. I need to feed our visitor here for the village. And the friend inside says, don't bother me. My kids are sleeping. My animals are rested. I cannot get up and give you anything. Jesus expects his disciples to say, that is the most far out thing I've ever could imagine. Of course that would never happen. That's impossible to happen. That's outrageous. That's outthinkable. That's beyond the pale. And yet we Westerners read that passage and assume that's exactly what the person inside meant.
I like to think of the disciples as chuckling at that point.
Yeah, chuckling at the absolute ludicrousness of that ever happening in their culture, because they know the issues of honor and shame. They know the issues of social reciprocity and mandatory hospitality. They know the issues of honor and shame, not just personally, but the issues of honor and shame for the whole village. Because when any visitor shows up, the honor of the village is on the line. They must provide hospitality. Everyone in the village is mobilized like a red alert scramble to pull everything together to maintain the honor of the village and to give whatever visitor it is more than they could possibly eat at the triclinium table.
Getting back for just a moment here to the wedding at Cana, do we understand from the text that this was probably a wealthy family having the wedding?
Whatever inference we can make might be traceable to the fact that they have five purification jars. And fascinatingly enough, John gives us the capacity of them, 20 to 30 gallons. I love that specificity. Because when you start to do the calculations of if we fill each one of them up and we assume the average here is 25 gallons, and then we take a 750 milliliter wine bottle, which is the standard almost quart-sized bottle that we use today, Jesus made 800 bottles of the finest wine.
Sounds.
The significance of that is this, and maybe we ought to tidy this up here because we're heading toward Thanksgiving, is that wine is the symbol of joy in this culture. And pretty much Jesus is saying and suggesting here, your pursuit of observant Judaism's with all of these rules and regulations, all these ritual purification protocols, all of the ever-expanding amount of creative interpretations by the rabbis of what's clean and unclean, is become burdensome. The yoke is heavy. Mm-hmm. Remember when Jesus said, my yoke is easy, my burden is light?
Yes.
The contrast here is the yoke of the rabbis now. All the regulations that have been piled on top of the Torah are so burdensome that they have wrung the joy out of this culture. And Jesus is basically, at the beginning of his ministry here, I have come to restore joy to a relationship, a spiritual relationship, not an obligatory behavior religious relationship with my Father. And so one of the messages he's communicating here is, I am the one who's going to bring joy back to a relationship with my Heavenly Father. The second thing he's going to do is to say, my blood is going to be that which eternally purifies, not the everyday ritual purification of this water. You have to do it over and over and over again with this water, but what I'm going to do on the cross is going to do it once and for all. And so I'm going to convert this ritual purification water into wine, the symbolism of my shed blood.
Doug, you made the wedding of Cana a much more powerful and all-consuming episode in Jesus' ministry than I've ever considered. It's pretty special.
And may your joy at Thanksgiving be complete.
And yours too. Doug Greenwald, Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director at Preserving Bible Times. You want to visit their website. It's a gorgeous website, and you can discover a lot of things there, from books and DVDs and, well, even to Doug's newsletter, his monthly newsletter that he refers to as Reflections. If you'd like to visit it, you can link to it conveniently from BrokenRoadRadio.com. See on the right side of the homepage, it says Preserving Bible Times. Click on that. It'll take you there. Doug, you and Nancy have a great Thanksgiving. We'll talk to you next week, okay?
And the same for you and yours, Jim. And same for David. Pass it along.
Shalom, Doug.
Shalom, shalom.